From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. President Biden has announced a plan to withdraw troops from Afghanistan and end the so-called forever war.
The presence of international forces and U.S. support for the Kabul-based government has really precluded the serious negotiations and resolution of the conflict that's required.
We'll talk about it with Michigan Congressman and Army veteran Peter Meyer. An Ann Arbor artist is looking to make the tattoo world more inclusive.
I designed flowers that go around fat rolls, and they don't hide them, they actually highlight them.
And as case rates soar above 30% in parts of Michigan's Thumb region, we'll check in with one restaurant owner in Port Huron.
With the numbers spiking so much, we made our own decision to close the dining room again.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. As Michigan's COVID infection rate continues to burn into the red, with Governor Whitmer urging people to stay put, a couple of high-ranking state health officials did some spring break traveling.
The Department of Health and Human Services is telling people not to travel amid this surge of COVID-19 cases in the state. And the director of that department was on a plane flight down to Alabama and back.
More on that story is coming up later in the hour. But first, we wanted to take a moment to mark President Joe Biden's announcement that United States troops will exit Afghanistan by September 11th of this year. It's the end of a military engagement that marked a turning point in U.S. foreign affairs. There are millions of adult Americans who grew up knowing only this conflict, seemingly a war without end. Will this represent a new chapter? For everyone who worked, sacrificed, or lost family in Afghanistan, this is a deeply mixed bag of feelings. Michigan's 3rd District Congressman Peter Meyer, Republican from Grand Rapids, joins us now. Congressman, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Pleasure to be here.
You tweeted this week that you're glad President Biden made this decision and made the announcement. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, absolutely. So initially, we had been slotted under the terms of the Doha agreement that had been negotiated with the Trump administration to withdraw all forces from Afghanistan by May 1st. Currently, we have around 2,500 military personnel in Afghanistan. So it's very much a residual presence that's mostly just involved in securing some of the remaining bases we have. But to your earlier point, it's definitely a bittersweet moment, but better than prolonging the inevitable.
Few people who follow Afghanistan believe that the current president, Ashraf Ghani, will be able to stay in power very long after the U.S. departs. If the goal was to stabilize a region that hosted hostile actors, can we really rationalize ending this operation?
Well, I think we have to remember what we went into Afghanistan for back in 2001, almost 20 years ago, and that was to deny al-Qaeda, an international terrorist organization, sanctuary. We're currently caught up in the midst of a civil war that we are able to be played off by both sides. And the reality is that the Kabul government has never exerted full control over the Afghan territory. Right now, it's frankly a country that is weaker than the sum of its parts. Many regional actors and former warlords or current warlords hold a lot more sway. And the presence of international forces and U.S. support for the Kabul-based government has really precluded the serious negotiations and resolution of the conflict that's required.
The Doha Agreement calls for the Taliban to make this commitment not to kill Americans. The terms of that agreement had U.S. troops leaving by May 1st. What do you think will happen if American troops or personnel are attacked or killed between May and September?
I think we will respond back vigorously and defend the security of our personnel who are there. And we retain that ability even after troops leave in order to make sure that we are able to mitigate terrorist threats. But the sad reality is that our broader ambitions, as they began to morph and as we had mission creep in the over the past 20 years from that simple notion of denying sanctuary to al-Qaeda so they couldn't plan and execute international terrorist incidents, that's been accomplished. And we need to rationalize, our ongoing efforts in the region.
The thing is, the Taliban are likely to play an important role, the same group that offered al-Qaeda sanctuary in the first place. The Taliban are likely to play an important role going forward. The Biden administration is trying to structure some talks between the Ghani regime and the Taliban and possibly some other stakeholders, the hope being that some power-sharing agreement can be reached, although prospects for that aren't super strong right now. Do you think we need to prepare ourselves for the eventuality of the Taliban retaking power?
I don't think it'll be as simple as the Taliban retaking power. And to be honest, when you get outside of Kabul, there's a lot less daylight between the Taliban and regional forces, as I think many in the West appreciate. I spent 2013 to 2015 in Afghanistan as a conflict analyst for the aid community. So, you know, from the outside, it seems to be a very black and white conflict, but it's anything but when you start to dive into the weeds and into the nuances of the regional conflict and the inter-Afghan disputes.
There's no question that there are many, many seats at this table. But in the past year or so, assassinations have been ticking upward against judges, against journalists, women in prominent jobs. It feels like it's not hard to see where this might be headed again.
And that's really been a campaign of intimidation that's been ongoing for the past several decades. When we look at the civilian fatalities, and it's not just the fatalities of being perpetrated by the Taliban, but it's also civilians caught up within the fighting. You know, the reality is that this is not a conflict that will be solved through military action alone. It will require a power-sharing agreement, and that's been something that we frankly started to negotiate back in 2001. So pre-invasion in October and November. So the Taliban view themselves as a government in exile. There is hope that there will be an ability to have those regional power-sharing agreements that recognize some of the historic tribal and ethnic prerogatives and frankly get away from this notion that we can just revamp a society when we're not willing to commit the forces, the time, the money, the blood and treasure to see that happen.
How do you define U.S. interests in Afghanistan at this moment?
Stability. I think that's the best that we can hope for. And again, stability is only going to arise through power sharing agreements. We've been turning the corner, in the words of generals and political officials, for the better part of two decades. And the joke in the veterans community has been, you know, we've turned the corner so much we have to be in a maze by now. And I think we have to be willing to align our ambitions with what we're willing to commit.
The costs of engagement in Afghanistan include, but certainly are not limited to, more than 2,300 American lives. The estimates of civilian deaths in country vary. They might number around 40,000, according to one review from Brown University. There are many, many more people in Afghanistan who are displaced. In total, do you think the losses have been justified, in your view?
I think, and this on the military side, as a veteran who served in Iraq and actually participated in that drawdown from 2010 to 2011, it's hard to look back or to look at a current moment, you know, with the anticipated withdrawal, with anything short of a feeling of bittersweet. This is not choosing between a great outcome and a bad outcome. It's trying to find the least worst possibility. And acknowledging the fact that if we continue the status quo, we're putting more American lives at risk. We're frankly putting more Afghan civilian lives at risk as well. It's better to face the reality now than to draw out the inevitable.
Iraq's actually kind of a tempting case study here. These are two very different countries, but the United States went through periods of drawdown followed by periods of reengagement. Do you think that the whole idea of a withdrawal, full stop, is perhaps misleading when we think about our engagement in Afghanistan in coming years?
When I consider withdrawal, I mean the physical presence of large numbers of U.S. troops. We'll still maintain diplomatic and intelligence capabilities. We'll still retain kinetic capabilities as well, but it'll be shifting, frankly, to the airstrikes that have been the marker of this conflict, at least for the past 5 years. So, you know, when you talk about Iraq, you know, we had in Iraq, one regional power, Iran, that really emphasized and drew a wedge between the Shia and Sunni populations, and in ways that the American presence in the final days of that conflict in 2010-2011 really exacerbated by failing to check the Maliki government and the way that they marginalized the Sunni community. So in some ways, you know, it's tempting to draw that analogy, but in other ways, I think we have to realize that when we're caught in the midst of a civil war, the only solution is going to be a political one.
One might argue that there's a parallel situation with the Taliban and Shia in Afghanistan. Do you think that's a relevant comparison?
When you speak of the Shia in Afghanistan, do you mean the Hazara population?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Hazara in Afghanistan are a much smaller minority that lack significant outside support. So the Shia in Iraq were, you know, de facto Iranian elements. In Afghanistan, the Hazara are very much a repressed minority in many places and have found themselves the target of some of the more nihilistic elements of the opposition to the government. When it comes to their protection, you know, we've seen in the past that there have been agreements with between the Taliban and the Hazaras. So I'm obviously concerned about the future of that population, but they have, you know, the historical retrenchment into alliances that predated 9/11, that predated the Soviet invasion, really call for a more comprehensive, you know, tying together of those fabrics. And again, that's something that cannot happen when you have the largest ethnic groups very much at war with the central government. But over what are oftentimes parochial or territorial disputes that can be resolved.
Part of what brought the United States to this place is the authorization for use of military force that was passed in 2001. Tell us about how quickly you think Congress needs to move to amend or end the authorization.
I've been a part of bipartisan efforts, including sponsoring a piece of legislation with several veterans on both sides of the aisle to repeal the 2002 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or AUMF, that authorized our engagement against Saddam Hussein in the 2003 war, in addition to the 91 AUMF for the Gulf War and a 57 AUMF that's still on the books from the Eisenhower era. So I firmly believe we need to repeal those full stop and then focus on reforms of the 01 AUMF. I've always tried to disconnect those 01 AUMF reforms from the operations in Afghanistan because the operations in Afghanistan were what that was intended to do, to go after al-Qaeda and associated forces. Now, we ended up using that 01 authorization to conduct operations in 18 other countries, you know, throughout Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, and in parts of Sub-Saharan Africa as well. So I think it's important that we address that expanse of the global war on terror, but also in ways that increase accountability. So I do not support a full repeal just yet of the 01 AUMF, but rather a reform of that process that targets authorizations based more narrowly on geography, on target, and then also having some type of time-bound element so that Congress has to reauthorize and approve rather than just letting these conflicts continue on autopilot.
Peter Meyer represents Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. He's joining us today from Washington. Congressman Meyer, thank you for your time.
Thank you, April.
Next up, one artist talks about creating a new kind of design written on the body. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The present generation of tattoo artists is making some change in the industry. For a long time, the person you'd go to for a tattoo was a rough around the edges guy doing traditional designs and lettering. That space could be a pretty intimidating space to walk into. Who else might tattoo art be made for? Can it create more inclusive community? Carrie Metz Caparuso of Ann Arbor is a tattoo artist with a new project that's about celebrating fat bodies as they are by creating beautiful work for them. And Carrie joins us now. Carrie, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Your Instagram feed is a place where you show some of the stuff that you've worked on recently. And there have been some images popping up in there of something you designed called roll flowers. Can you explain what roll flowers are?
Yeah. So I designed flowers that go around fat rolls and they don't hide them. They actually highlight them. And yeah, that's what they are.
Well, the thing that's, for those, this being radio, I think maybe we better describe it a bit. These are images of flowers whereby the petals, if you put exactly the same design on a thin-bodied person, it would actually look kind of disjointed. But you've made the design so that the lay of the petals must be seen on a fat-bodied person. And to be a complete design, how did you come up with the idea that there was an image that would only work on this type of body?
I literally sat myself down and looked at fat bodies, my own included, and I thought, what can I do to highlight these roles? And it took days. I tried multiple different designs, And then a light bulb just went off and I thought, oh yeah, the crease in the body would make a perfect stem. And you could only achieve that, like you said, with a fat body. And then it just went from there.
You, I noticed when I was looking through your Instagram feed, there was a caption on one of the posts where you called the roll flowers my love letters to myself and all the other fat babes. I'm so grateful for being able to share this with you all. Is it common that you have people coming to sit in the chair with you and you hear them making decisions about what they should get tattooed or where they should get tattooed with the idea that they want to change what they look like, that they might lose weight or gain weight somewhere?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the driving forces behind me designing this, was because I had a week where it was uncanny how many people sitting in my chair were saying, man, I'd really love to get a back tattoo, but I have to lose weight for it first. Or I really want my upper arms done, but I really need to lose weight first. And I thought that way a really long time, but I never lost weight. And once I decided to just get tattooed and look at myself as art, then I started feeling way better about my body. I think that getting tattooed gives you some ownership and you start looking at yourself differently. So I wanted to spread that to all the people that were thinking they should wait to get tattooed.
Yeah. I mean, are there things that you have said to people who walk into the shop with that kind of, with those kinds of reservations or those kinds of conditions for themselves?
Yeah, I've said, use me as an example. Like, I have my back done, I have my stomach done, and I feel great about it. It's changed the way I look at myself. And if it's worked for me and other people, it might work for you as well.
I've seen tattoos that were designed for people who had mastectomies that sort of celebrated a part of the body that the conventional wisdom would tell us that we have to hide. Do you know of any other traditions within tattoo art of encouraging people to look at their bodies as they are?
Not yet per se, but I'm hoping with this generation of new tattooers, we keep forging the way for bodies that aren't the stereotype. So I hope to see more of that eventually.
You know, it's kind of crazy when you start to think about it and you start to look at, you know, the hashtags for tattoos. So many of them feature thin white people who are extremely fit. And their tattoos do look amazing. And tattoos look great on those bodies. But what do you hope tattoos can come to mean for all kinds of folks, women, men, or non-binary customers who might sit in the chair, and especially those with fat bodies?
I hope that we can look at tattooing as something that's for everyone and we can start designing for everyone. Because like you said, you do only see thin white people and there's a lot of myths around tattooing that people with dark skin can't get color or fine line and fat people shouldn't get tattooed. And so if we just stop trying to hide these people and start highlighting what we can do with different bodies, I think that would make tattooing a much more inclusive place and for everyone.
Is there a specific craft that goes into working with customers who are looking to get inked and who are asking you to look at their fat bodies and figure out where and how to do this?
Yeah, I think when you're dealing with fat people or anyone, honestly, you should be informative. You should say, this is how this will look on you. It might not look the same way on other people, but this is how it'll be on you. And you should be neutral about whatever it is. Being fat isn't bad or good. It's just what it is. So we need to speak neutrally about people's bodies. And then consent is really huge before you touch people, before you ask them to remove clothing or whatever it is. You need to make sure people are safe and feel comfortable and consent to what you're doing. And if you do all those things, I think you can achieve a great tattoo for anyone.
Do you think that there are places that this design has taken you as you sat down and went through the exercise of creating the roll flowers? Do you think there are places that design, that tattoo design has not gone, that you might go in the future as you pursue this idea a little bit further?
Absolutely. I want to do more scene. I've done one, but I'd like to do more, turning the body into a scene or space, or there's just so many ways you can go about this. And the flowers are just one step. And I really hope to keep pushing and thinking of more new ways to celebrate fat bodies.
Carrie, do you mind telling us how you got into this line of work?
No, not at all. I was trying to be a tattooer, and I had my little drawings, and I went to multiple shops, and I was told, like, oh, it's too saturated, there's too many tattooers, or, oh, your artwork isn't what tattoos look like. And I was feeling pretty discouraged until I happened to randomly meet my partner at a party, and we hit it off, and he was like, I'm a tattooer and I could absolutely help you. So I kind of got an apprenticeship and a partner all rolled into one whirlwind year. But yeah, that's how I got in. It's pretty difficult to get in.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking today with Carrie Metz Caparuso. They're an Ann Arbor-based tattoo artist whose latest project celebrates fat bodies. You mentioned that you were concerned early on that your art style wasn't really what people might want out of tattoos. For folks who haven't seen your feed, could you describe your work?
I do very delicate, fine line black work. It's can range from super cute and cartoony to a little bit more realistic, but it's very far from what you would typically think of like American traditional tattooing.
Looking at your stuff, you've got some things that are a lot of botanical work and some things that are figurative, but it's really, it's like illustration work in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, I describe it as like black illustration, which is just in the past, I'd say maybe decade, starting to really take off in the tattoo world and become pretty popular now.
What has it been like finding the market for people who want that kind of art?
For me, it's been pretty great because when I started in New York, where it was a pretty trendy style, and then when I moved to Michigan in 2013, no one was really doing it in this area. So I kind of saw the opportunity and pounced, and it's been really great for me because it's just really taken off here.
When you first started, when you met up with your partner and you were sort of finding your way into the field, who were most of the tattoo artists that you knew?
He was honestly the only tattooer I knew. But then I was taught how to tattoo traditionally, American traditional. So I used to be very into the traditional culture and follow all the big, you know, traditional guys who led in that field, like Chad Koplinger and other big names like that.
What do you see happening now in the cohort of people who are working in shops in Michigan and elsewhere?
I have noticed such a shift in, there's so many queer folks like myself now. I've seen so many women joining tattooing. I have now found a bunch of black tattooers, Asian, like it's just so nice to see tattooing start to shift away from just being white cis male. It's really cool to see.
Are there still barriers for people who want to get into the industry and maybe provide some different options for customers who aren't looking for an American traditional style?
Absolutely. There's still barriers because tattooing, the main way you learn how to tattoo is by getting an apprenticeship. And no matter if it's malicious or not, I think people naturally choose people that are more like them. So that's, I think, what was keeping white men picking other white men, picking other white men. That's what was keeping it not terribly diverse. But I think people are now making the conscious decision to get other types of people into tattooing. I've seen a lot of people now kind of sidestep the getting an apprenticeship and kind of teaching themselves, which to the tattoo industry, people don't really like. But I know so many amazing artists who are self-taught. My partner is one and broke into the tattoo community. So I think it was kind of out of necessity of people getting really tired of saying, like, hearing no, you can't tattoo, no, I won't teach you, no. So it's really cool to see people just say, you know what, forget it, I'm going to teach myself, get good enough, and I'll break it on my own. So I think that's a cool way to kind of say, hey, whatever, I don't need this apprenticeship, I don't need your approval, I'll get in my own way.
I think a lot of us traditionally tend to think of tattoo as a statement art. You know, people who want a very specific reaction when people see their tattoos. Again, sort of tied to the old style. But since tattoo is by definition kind of an outsider art form, there's also this tradition of tattoo artists being you know, sort of exploring in different ways and being involved in their communities in different ways. Do you think that tattoo is coming into a time when it can mean different things, when it can truly mean illustration on the body, as people think of tattoos as a way to tell their personal story instead of maybe affiliating themselves with something that's already out there?
Absolutely. I think it's the best form of individualism, even though people do have, like, it's very popular now. But the range of what I see some people just getting one tiny little heart and never plan on getting any more tattoos. And it's very personal for them. Or people who just want their kids' names because that's all they really want. Like, they're not looking to make such a statement. They're just looking to have a keepsake or a memory and hold that, you know, part of time on their bodies so they can remember. So it's just for them.
Carrie, tattooing was one of the industries that was hit pretty hard early on by shutdowns because it's such a close proximity that artists have to have with clients when they're doing a tattoo. How's business been since you opened back up?
You know what? You would think that COVID would have slowed down tattooing. But I have noticed with other accounts that I follow, people are posting things like, I'm so busy, I'm booked out months, I'm sorry my books are closed, and my books have been closed for like 8 months, and tattooing has just exploded. The business is incredibly booming right now, and I cannot explain that.
I was kind of curious if you have anything new on yourself these days.
I do my very latest tattoo. I like to do really big fundraisers, but because of COVID, we can't have hundreds of people, you know, waiting in line outside of the shop. So I did a fundraiser, and it was a raffle that if you want to try to tattoo me, if you win the raffle, you can tattoo me. So one of my good clients, Beth Chapman, she won the raffle and very begrudgingly came in. She did not want to do it, but she did it, and she gave me just a cute tiny little tattoo, and she did a good job.
Carrie, that is so brave that you were willing to just open up your own canvas that way. Wasn't it scary? I mean, were you worried that maybe the person who won the raffle might be a little more ambitious than you were ready for?
Well, I picked the design, so that's good. And I it's not the first time I've had non-tattooers tattoo me. I've had a few friends, you know, want to try. So I'm like, hey, why not? As long as it's small and I'm there to teach you and help you, it's not too terrifying for me.
You are fearless.
Thank you.
If this is too personal, please don't feel obliged to answer. But do you have a favorite of the things on your skin?
I think my favorite, which is a bummer, I can't see it very much because it's on the back of my thigh, but I have a very colorful Miss Piggy on the back of my thigh, which I like back there because when I walk away, I'm like, yep, I'm fat and fabulous, and Miss Piggy is such a fabulous fat icon, so I really love having her back there supporting me.
Like you said, you've got a pretty busy schedule these days. If there are people out there who want to get your Roll Flower tattoos and either don't live near you or can't wait for your books to open up. Are you open to other artists maybe adapting the design?
I want everyone to know you don't have to come to me to get a roll flower. You can, you know, use my pictures as inspiration and ask your local artist if they can do something similar. Don't steal my work. But but yeah, I just want everyone to know this is available to them. You don't have to ask my permission. It's just for everyone. Anyone who wants it, you can have it.
Carrie Metz Caparuso is in practice in Ann Arbor, and you can see her tattoos and some of the things that she's been working on lately on her Instagram feed. Carrie, it's been awesome to meet you. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. I had a lovely time.
Coming up, Michigan's Thumb Region has some of the highest rates of COVID-19 in the country. So what's it like to be running a business there?
When you see somebody that comes in without a mask, even though we've got posts everywhere, must wear a mask until you're seated, and they walk in without it, and we ask them, they look at me like I'm an alien, like they're hearing it for the first time, and say, well, we don't have to do that anywhere else. It's like, well, that's the reason why this pandemic keeps going on and everybody's still getting sick.
We'll check in with the owner of one restaurant in Port Huron right after a quick break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. COVID-19 cases in Michigan have topped what they were even at the height of the surge last fall. That's despite much wider availability of vaccines. One area hit particularly hard is St. Clair County, home to Port Huron. The county is seeing a 30% case positivity rate at the moment. This dire situation has led some restaurants in the area to hard decisions about indoor service. And one of those is the very popular Raven Cafe in downtown Port Huron. Its owner, Sadat Hossein, joins us now. Hey, Sadat, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me.
For those who've never had the pleasure, can you tell us a little bit about what the Raven is like during normal times?
During normal times, it's absolutely lovely. It's two-level. Looks like an old English library. Everything is all hand-formed wood. There's a full espresso bar. We have 8 rotating Michigan microbrews, a full line of craft spirits and cocktails. Last I checked, there's over 80,000 different drink concoctions we can do. We have lots of sandwiches, salads, appetizers, pizzas, 9 soups that we rotate with. And when we are not in the middle of a pandemic, we have live music 3 nights out of the week. We have a very popular trivia night, and we show films, usually cult classics, once a week on our upper balcony.
I mean, suffice to say, this is one of those spots that's very much about vibe and very much about community, right?
Absolutely. It's kind of like Cheers met Hogwarts.
What has been going on with your opening status ever since COVID began?
Well, since COVID began, we shut our dining room down immediately, and we had to be creative with what we were going to do with all of my displaced wait staff. Many of them chose to self-quarantine, and I was basically left with a third of my front of the house staff. So I would have one bartender, and then one server would be a delivery driver. And we expanded our delivery hours. Usually it was just for lunchtime delivery for bigger offices, things like that, large groups, catering, things like that. But then we lowered our minimum from $30 to $20, and we would deliver to anybody in Marysville, Port Huron, Fort Gratiot, and Wadhams. And that was a way that my wait staff could still maintain some kind of income level if they didn't want to self-quarantine or just go on unemployment completely. We retooled our whole dining room, put a small gift shop area in the front, moved a bunch of our tables out. We were lucky enough to have our friend next door at Border Keep Games, Mr. Greg Campbell, let us store half of our tables and chairs in his basement. We put all of our coffee beans, our chai tea mix, our t-shirts, our merchandise, all of that right in the front so you could shop the area while you're waiting for your takeout.
And then came the shining moment when you were able to reopen for indoor dining. Did you find business picked up very much?
We actually played it safe. About the middle of the summer was when everybody was to reopen. By then, of course, many people had the pandemic fatigue, I think they call it, where they wanted to get out. They wanted to see people. They were fed up of being stuck inside. So, I mean, as soon as the other restaurants opened their doors, it was like the floodgates opened. And I just, every time I drive by one, I'd see everywhere is packed. I'm like, I am not about to do that, because just because people want the pandemic to be over doesn't mean it is. So we chose to stay closed for the duration of the summer. Once we got our bearings and kept an eye on the numbers, watching them decline a little bit just before the fall, we did reopen at a limited capacity, 50%. And then there was another government mandate to shut down around the holidays. So we were only open from September through the end of October. And when we were allowed to reopen at 25% capacity, we did in February and March. But recently, with the numbers spiking so much, we made our own decision to close the dining room again.
What made up your mind?
Just watching the numbers. It's scary. We are, St. Clair County is literally the worst in the nation right now. I was watching other restaurants who didn't have staff because they were all getting ill, probably from the indoor dining. To be honest, if I had to make an educated, somewhat scientific guess. So we didn't want the same thing to happen to our staff where, you know, they were getting sick, so we wouldn't have anybody to work for us. So we just got ahead of the game and decided to revert back to our takeout, delivery, and curbside offerings.
You know, at this point, the state is signaling that it's not going to impose any more restrictions or regulations, but just is asking people to make decisions and do the right thing. Do you get any sense of how many other restaurants downtown or in the county also chose to go takeout only?
There's a lot of them downtown. And in fact, a few of them elected to close their dining room before us, albeit it was a few days before. But watching them do that, especially the ones that are, let's say notorious about, you know, being open, having their dining room open and not, you know, not letting anything stand in their way. So watching them do that, I was like, wow, things are really getting real if they're doing that. The problem that I'm seeing with all the restaurants in the county in general is that as a business owner that takes these regulations seriously, is that when you see somebody that comes in without a mask, even though we've got posts everywhere, must wear a mask until you're seated, and they walk in without it, and we ask them, they look at me like I'm an alien, like they're hearing it for the first time, and so, well, we don't have to do that anywhere else. It's like, well, that's the reason why this pandemic keeps going on and everybody's still getting sick. I would urge other business owners to take it seriously and actually follow the rules and the capacity restrictions and the social distancing and the masks. You know, if we want to get out of this, we've all got to be in this together.
What are you hearing from folks around you and maybe customers about whether or not they intend to get vaccinated?
From what I'm seeing on social media, things aren't looking very good. I know that there's some people that are waiting to see what happens, you know, if, you know, you grow a third arm after 8 months or something. But for the most part, a lot of the industry workers that I know and my staff particularly are all about it, you know, anything to stop the spread. And from what I've seen, it's been the ones that had it, or it's they've got a positive outlook and it's a pretty optimistic. Things are looking up for that. Now, if other people that are on the fence about it or just outright aren't choosing to get it, could maybe be swayed to go ahead and play ball, then maybe things will start looking up in the county.
The question about what's going to help your business survive, I know, is probably tough right now, but do you think you'll be able to keep the business going without the muscle of state restrictions?
We've been very fortunate to have not only the support of the community and our regulars still ordering from us. There's also been a lot of aid from the EDA through grants, through the PPP and the EIDA loans, all of the Small Business Association loans and forgivable loans and grants and things. We're actually looks like we're treading water and we should be able to get out of this on the other side, optimistically.
Sadat, you've been on and off of this merry-go-round so many times during the course of this pandemic. I was curious what you think of the governor's approach this time around, more hands-off. Do you think the appeal she's making to personal responsibility is going to resonate or is going to be enough to slow down what's happening?
I feel like she's got so much flack for imposing restrictions in the past that even though right now would be the right time to put a lockdown into effect or impose restrictions, she is counting on people to make the right move. But if history has shown us anything, specifically in this area, if people are left to their own devices to make their own decisions, they're not going to make those decisions. They're going to work in their own best interest and just kind of try to power through it. And that's a scary thought. And it's not really cool for the people that have been following the rules from the start, like us. So I really do feel like she's just trying to save face by letting people make their own decisions and not imposing anything. But with all the things that have happened to her and all the things that have been said about her about imposing restrictions, I kind of can't blame her for wanting to maybe take more of a hands-off approach on this one on a personal level. I mean, if I feared for the safety of myself by folks that are that against her orders, then I probably would be acting in my own interest too.
Sadat Hussein is the owner of the Raven Cafe in Port Huron. Sadat, it's great to hear your voice. Stay safe.
Thank you. You as well, and all the listeners.
While Michiganders are being asked to stay home and stay safe just a bit longer, it appears that some top state administrators are not necessarily sticking to that guidance. This week, several news sources reported that the head of Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services and the state's chief operating officer both traveled out of state for spring break. At a time when Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration is trading the rules and restrictions for responsible personal decision-making, the message is mixed at best. Chad Livengood is a senior editor at Crain's Detroit Business, and he's been following all this. Hey, Chad.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me, April.
So what do we know about Dr. Elizabeth Hertel's trip? She's the head of DHHS.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Hertel went on a trip with her family, including her husband, State Senator Curtis Hertel Jr., to Alabama, to the Gulf Shores of Alabama, and went on a spring break, took their kids. They say that they isolated. She also worked remotely, like a lot of people have done during the pandemic. They've gone to nicer locales to work and taken the sites when they're not working. But at the same time, her department put out an advisory urging people against travel and sort of in anticipation of a huge surge of people traveling out of state for spring break. And so it seemed to really ring contradictory that the Department of Health and Human Services is telling people not to travel and amid this surge of COVID-19 cases in the state. And the director of that department was on a plane flight down to Alabama and back.
Awkward. Could you remind us who Tricia Foster is and where she was over spring break?
So Trish Foster is the state's chief operating officer. She was previously the head of the Department of Management and Budget. She is a longtime friend, a confidant of Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Previously worked in the real estate, commercial real estate industry in Grand Rapids, and so she posted a photo of her daughters on spring break, teenage daughters on spring break down in Florida on a beach, and that immediately got some criticism. She also noted, and haven't got really a lot of answers about this yet from the governor's office, that her son didn't go because he had COVID-19. Now, I don't know enough about whether her son lives at home or is in college, but haven't been able to get an answer out of the governor's office yet about, you know, was there contact, because this is important, because Elizabeth Hertel's department says if you've made contact with people or been exposed to someone with COVID-19, you definitely should not travel anywhere. And you're really supposed to quarantine just so that you haven't spread the virus. So a lot of questions about these two top aides. Now, Trish Foster, in her role as the chief operating officer, is in charge of vaccine distribution in Michigan and overseeing that across multiple government agencies. And so, again, you know, just kind of major glaring question here. The governor was out discouraging spring break travel, or at least saying she's concerned about it and concerned about people bringing the virus from Florida and people taking the virus to Florida. And then she's got two of her top aides who advise her on all these major decisions with the pandemic, who went on spring break, sort of in contradiction of the advice.
Wow. So all of this has sort of been breaking as within 24 hours, and Governor Whitmer has had one press conference. Has Governor Whitmer had anything to say about this apparent breach of the personal responsibility message?
The governor pushed back on this yesterday and said this is an attack on or a partisan attack on her top aides, and she was not going to engage in it. She did make a comment that was not accurate. She said there's never been any travel restrictions in Michigan. And if you want to go back in the Wayback Machine to last April, there was a prohibition on travel for non-essential reasons across the state. And if you didn't own a second home, remember, you might recall initially the rules and the executive orders basically seemed to suggest that people with second homes couldn't go to those second homes. That was partly because, you know, people in Petoskey didn't want people in Birmingham bringing the virus to Petoskey. And so then they eased it up and let people with second homes go to those second homes. But it still said that, you know, if you don't own a second home, you can't be going up north and getting a hotel in Traverse City. And that remained in effect until Memorial Day. And you might recall that also was a spinoff of that controversy where the governor's own husband went up to his cottage up in Antrim County to rake some leaves, as we were told, and made a phone call to the local dock guy trying to see if he could get his dock put in. And that he stirred a controversy because he made some comment that the governor later had to apologize for, that that he was seeing whether he could get preferential treatment to get his dock in because his wife's the governor. So this is a whole, you know, basket of issues. And so for the governor to say there was no travel restrictions is not exactly correct.
So, Chad, what is going on here? Governor Whitmer was an early adopter of tightening restrictions last year. In recent months, she has softened her stance as the outbreak has raged on. She's been tough on other officials for ignoring science or ignoring public health recommendations. Is there something that we're missing here in the bigger picture of the administration? I mean, not to suggest that Republicans haven't sometimes been seen skipping mask laws or distancing, but what is going on Whitmer's side of this?
Yeah, it just came from the Capitol. A lot of Republicans not wearing masks there, legislators. But this is not the Whitmer doctrine that we had come to get used to, or at least had seen in full practice, both in the spring surge, the continued regulations. Just think about how bowling alleys weren't allowed to reopen last summer, even when cases were in the couple hundreds a day. And now we're at 7,000 cases a day, and bowling alleys are still open. I mean, so this is, again, part of one of the criticisms from the start is there's been inconsistency. Republicans will say that this is all political science, not necessarily epidemiology and public health science. But I think in the background here, there is definitely fatigue from the populace for these type of regulations, for shutdowns in general. They become so politicized. I think that's one of the that's frankly one of the calculus is that just the political capital has to get spent to do another shutdown is pretty great. But at the same time, when you almost have one in five hospital beds being filled. Beaumont Hospital is putting up tents for triage right now outside of their hospitals in Oakland and Wayne County. That just screams disaster is sort of looming here for the healthcare system.
Chad Livengood of Crane's Detroit Business. Chad, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.